Welcome to New World Notes. This is Kenneth Doust. In December, journalist Dar Jamail published a fine two-part series on rape in the military. Rape is epidemic in the U.S. military. It's homosexual as well as heterosexual, and the facts are hushed up by the Pentagon. Victims who report it don't get treatment, but they do get persecuted, and their rapists get promoted. Let's be clear, we're not talking about soldiers raping foreign civilians in a war zone. We're talking about U.S. soldiers raping other U.S. soldiers and getting away with it. We'll hear Dar Jamail in a fine conversation on the subject with Dory Smith, host of Talk Nation Radio. Rape in the military isn't news to many. What makes Jamail's words so interesting is not only the facts he reports, but his analysis of why the problem is so bad and getting rapidly worse. Jamail thinks that at least one reason is changes in how the military trains soldiers. Soldiers are trained to be much more willing to kill, much more willing to follow all orders, including illegal and immoral orders, compared with soldiers of previous generations. Jamail speaks of the military's intentional dehumanization of our soldiers today. And once you've been made into a killing machine, capable of committing any number of war crimes against primarily civilians, what moral scruples will hold you back from raping that little PFC in the next barracks? Jamail mentions a second growing epidemic among soldiers, besides rape, and that is post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. He ties both problems, in part, back to the same cause, dehumanization. Does that sound a bit far-fetched? Wait until we hear from Robert Fisk, following Dar Jamail. Fisk is focusing on American soldiers' newfound willingness to torture since 2002. And guess what? He traces it to the very same cause. First, here's Dar Jamail, speaking with Dory Smith in late December. One last note. They use the term MST. That stands for Military Sexual Trauma. That's what happens to the victim.
Dar Jamail, I want to turn now to the stories that you've been writing about military sexual trauma, MST. Rape evidently rampant in the U.S. military. And let's start with what you wrote about Susan Avila Smith, who advocates for veterans and finds the command not taking these crimes seriously.
Only because enough pressure has been put on the Pentagon by actually certain folks in Congress and senators, but then primarily, of course, because of groups like Susan Avila Smith and the Service Women's Action Network, SWAN, and most recently the ACLU, who just last week filed a lawsuit against the Pentagon trying to force them to reveal records they continue to withhold that really show the deep extent of the amount of military sexual assault and harassment in the military. And to address the question of is this getting worse or is anything the Pentagon doing having any effect, well, according to the Pentagon's own report just released last week, when we talk about just the U.S. military academies, that the incidence of reported rape, sexual assault, and sexual harassment has risen 60% over last year. This is clearly a show that whatever they're doing is failing dismally and not correcting what people like Susan Avila Smith and other activists and advocates like herself see as a deep structural problem that will not be corrected without radical systemic change.
We also spoke with the Yale Law students who are working with SWAN, the Service Women's Action Network, and ACLU on the case you mentioned, and they told us that the types of acts we're talking about, military sexual trauma, occur nearly twice as often in the military as they do in the general public. Now, is that consistent with what you found in your research for your Al Jazeera report?
What I'm seeing is that there's all these advocates and groups and study groups are actively pressuring the Pentagon. The recent ACLU lawsuit, including some of the groups you just mentioned, to really force them to reveal records they have that really would show the deep extent of the problem and how systemic it is and also how flawed the Pentagon's response has been. I mean, just let me give you an idea. One of the people I quote in my article that Al Jazeera released on Tuesday is a Pentagon spokesperson that I called to say, look, I want to give you time in this article to comment, and please tell the reader what is the Pentagon doing specifically about this. And she basically cited several different PR campaigns that they're involved in, things like a Sexual Assault Awareness Month and T-shirts and buttons and things like this. And I said, okay, well, in addition to PR work, really what programs are instituted, what systemic changes is the Pentagon doing to address what even they admit is a real problem? She basically said, look, we're basically asking people to watch each other's backs. And that is a really sad state of affairs when the Pentagon, who itself, who I quote several other people, even high-ranking folks in the Department of Defense, of publicly admitting this is a deep problem. It's been ongoing for years, and definitely major changes need to be made. And yet all we continue to get is lip service from the Pentagon and no real changes. And that's why I quote people like Marisa LaGuzman and people like April Fitzsimmons, both women who were formerly in the military, both women who were sexually assaulted, and both of them also participated in the formation of the Service Women's Action Network, SWAN, who is actually party to the federal lawsuit that the ACLU just filed against the Pentagon to try to get the records released. Well, both of these women told me, and I quote them in the article, that we were big fans of the military, we wanted to serve, we were proud of our service, but things are so bad now in regards to NFP in the military that we're telling people, any women that we run into, that until something radically changes in the Pentagon to address this problem, no woman anywhere should join the U.S. military today.
In one case you mention, a command sergeant tells a victim of rape, there aren't but two places for women, in a kitchen or in the bedroom, and women have no place in the military. In another case, a sergeant told the court to believe that a veteran alleging rape was quote-unquote promiscuous. And so you're saying here that the victims are telling you that the worst part is not being found credible and not being able to count on their commanders or the DOD to protect them.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, the woman I just mentioned, April Fitzsimmons, actually spoke to me directly about that. She said, look, in the military, I mean, it doesn't take someone who's really familiar with military culture to understand it's deeply misogynistic. It's very male-favored. It's basically a big boys' club. And she said that it creates, therefore, within itself, its own culture, whereas the perpetrator is going to be walking away scot-free. That, for starters, if a woman or man who's a victim of sexual assault, and let's be clear, approximately 10% of men in the military are also victims of MST. But we don't really hear much about that. And in fact, given that men comprise most of the military, by far and away, there's far more male victims of MST than even women. But that said, given the culture in the military of it being basically a boys' club, and that if anything happens, you're supposed to just suck it up and be tough and just keep marching forward, that instead of a victim's confidentiality being respected by the doctor or chaplain or doctor that they report the MST to, instead rumors are spread, and it actually creates a much more dangerous climate for victims who report it, and in fact makes them much more likely to be victimized yet again. That's the really extreme climate that people who are victims of MST in the military have to try to survive within once they report it.
And it sounds as if a big part of the reason that soldiers, veterans, would not come forward to talk about these attacks is that they sense that they're not going to be supported. Another attorney, you write, asked a soldier in court why she didn't fight her attacker off.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's that same culture that I was just talking about encourages victim silence. Again, you're not supposed to speak up, and then if you do, you're further victimized, and you're actually blamed. It's the classic blame the victim scenario that comes out. In fact, the one incident that you mentioned here, the woman was raped by another soldier, and then it did go to court. You know, she spoke up about it. It did miraculously go to court martial, of which, of course, only a minute percentage of people who are victims of MST in the military actually do see their cases go to a court-martial. And then, of course, it was argued that she's a soldier. Why did she fight back? Maybe she actually wanted this to happen. And that's actually very, very typical. So, in fact, off the top of my head, and I lined this out in the article, approximately 4% of all incidents of MST even get reported. Only 2% of those actually go to court-martial. And then of those that go to court-martial, of course, the vast, vast majority, over 90% of the perpetrators, end up walking away. And, in fact, the majority of those end up getting promoted, whereas the victim either has to leave the military altogether or sometimes even get demoted.
Now, in the first part of this special, you write about a veteran named April Fitzsimmons, a victim of sexual assault. And in explaining why she would not urge women to join the military, she says, quote, "When victims come forward, they are ostracized and isolated from their communities. Many of the perpetrators are officers who use their ranks to coerce women to sleep with them. It's a closely interwoven community, so they're safe and move fearlessly among their victims." That's a chilling description of what's going on, isn't it?
It really is. And if you're a woman in the military, or if you're a woman thinking about joining the U.S. military today, you need to understand that that is a very clear, accurate, concise description of exactly the climate that you will be operating in, even if you're personally not assaulted. But let's talk about the bigger picture, because we've been talking about very, very specific examples. But I want to just throw some statistics out there, and these are even in addition to the ones I mentioned earlier, the staggering statistics that even in the military academies, in the most recent report that was announced by the Pentagon last week, there's been a 60% increase in people being sexually assaulted and harassed at the military academies, a 60% increase over just last year. But more broadly, looking at the entire military, we're continuing to see increases year to year. The most recent Pentagon report, looking at the military more broadly in terms of MST, we've seen an 11% increase of the most recent report over the previous year. So again, even more broadly, not just talking about the military academies themselves, but the entire military is seeing very, very significant increases despite their lip service, despite them claiming to be doing all that they can be doing. But that said, a Veterans Administration statistic show that 1 in 3 women that they screen are actually admitting to being victims of MST while they were in the military. So whether they're still active or whether they're vets themselves, the women that the VA are talking to are actually reporting that 1 out of 3 of them are victims. And then that goes alongside a Pentagon report that came out a couple of years ago that admitted within this report that 80% of all incidents of rape and sexual assault in the military never go reported. And so I'm not saying let's put those together and show that about 100% of women in the military are going to be victimized, but those two statistics held up side by side certainly show it's probably a safe bet to assume that more than half the women, conservatively more than half the women in the military at some point in their career are either going to be sexually assaulted or sexually harassed. Those are very, very bad odds. I mean, if you have a 1 in 2 chance of walking down a dark alley and coming out the other side alive, I think most people would probably not go down that path.
Now, if the Government Accounting Office has information about this, as you write, you know, that's something that Congress can get access to. So it's not then a matter of, you know, not knowing, but of not going far enough with what they do know.
Well, clearly. I mean, I think everything that we've talked about so far related to the Pentagon's and the Department of Defense's reaction to this crisis, I feel like it's implied that not only are they not doing enough to be forthcoming with the information, I mean, clearly they're not, or the ACLU and other women soldiers advocacy groups wouldn't be filing federal lawsuits in an attempt to force them to disclose the true extent of the crisis. Not only are they trying to hide it, but I think they're deliberately misrepresenting themselves and obfuscating the facts and trying to lead people to believe something other than the truth, that, you know, basically saying, okay, well, we understand that there's an issue here and we understand that we have to deal with it, and we are, because look at all these PR campaigns that we're running and look at all this lip service that we're giving it. But I think that the Pentagon understands that for this to change, the radical systemic change that would have to happen, you know, like don't ask, don't tell is repealed, which is certainly a positive thing as far as civil rights go, but that will really do nothing to fundamentally address this intensely male-dominated, misogynistic culture within the U.S. military. And the other component that I think probably scares the Pentagon is that the links they've gone to train people to be willing to kill. Let's keep in mind that after World War II, studies showed that during that time, only 1 in 10 American soldiers would actually shoot to kill, because it's inherent in most human beings a desire not to kill another human being. Well, they radicalized their training to the extent that when it came around to our recent wars over in the Middle East, 9 out of 10 U.S. soldiers are willing to shoot to kill. So they flipped that statistic. And they've done that by not only dehumanizing the quote-unquote other that is going to be put before American soldiers when they go abroad, but you can't dehumanize another without inherently dehumanizing the soldiers themselves. And this is what I've seen through all my work with vets on my second book and the ensuing articles, that these people have been thoroughly, thoroughly dehumanized. This starts at basic training when they're called every four-letter word in the book and other derogatory dehumanizing terms, and it goes on through their entire military career. And that's the type of thing that would have to change. I mean, you can't have as policy a deep systemic dehumanization process aimed at each and every soldier, man and woman, and then expect them to treat each other with dignity and respect, and expect that there wouldn't be problems like internal violence and murders and sexual assaults within the military. So that is specifically the deep systemic change that would have to take place. And, of course, that means the Pentagon would probably have to give up a little bit as far as having fewer soldiers who are willing to race out and kill the first thing that stands in front of them. And, of course, the Pentagon's unwilling to do that.
In military sexual trauma, you're also talking about a broader subject to include PTSD. And, I mean, there's a new way of looking at PTSD now to involve questions about moral injuries to soldiers and PTSD as a kind of symptom of a moral injury. But it seems to me, too, that what you're talking about is a moral decline in the military, you know, possibly as a result of soldiers not being able to react normally, possibly one that's being cultivated, it seems to me, you know, as a way of getting soldiers to become what, tougher? I don't know.
Well, to be killers that won't question orders, that won't go there morally in their own heads about whether this is right or this is wrong. Of course, it's in direct contravention of the oath that people have to swear allegiance to when they become soldiers, which is to be duty-bound to support and defend the U.S. Constitution by following lawful orders. It's interesting to me because the military is training, which is basically follow orders no matter what, do not question them, especially when it comes to when you're ordered to go kill somebody. That basically completely ignores the oath they swore, which is an allegiance to follow lawful orders in order to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. So this is something that I think is a very, very important point. And I think that what you said is extremely relevant about one of the effects, I think, of PTSD is this deep contradiction where soldiers are trained heavily to basically go follow orders, use violence, you know, no matter what, because you're told to do it, and yet that goes against their human nature, their own sense of morality, what they know to be right and wrong, and certainly if they're versed in the Geneva Conventions and international law, that oftentimes they understand, hey, this isn't my father's military, you know, I didn't know I was going to join up and be ordered to go run in and raid houses in Iraq and shoot 10-year-old kids on a regular basis, as has been told to me directly by several of the soldiers I interviewed for my second book about the will to resist. And so it's a very interesting phenomenon, I think a very important one, and I would imagine that there's some studies on this, certainly in psychology, showing that a big factor that causes PTSD is this internal schism between what people in the military know to be right and morally correct, and then what they're being ordered to do, which is oftentimes in direct violation of international law.
If you love this land of the free, bring them home, bring them home. Bring them back from overseas, bring them home, bring them home. It'll make the politicians sad, I know. Bring them home, bring them home. They want to tangle with their foe. Bring them home, bring them home. They want to test the grand theory. Bring them home, bring them home. With the blood of you and me. Bring them home, bring them home. We'll give no more brave young lives. Bring them home, bring them home. For the gleam in someone's eyes. Bring them home, bring them home. Men will cheer and the boys will shout. Bring them home, bring them home. And we will all turn out. Bring them home, bring them home. The church bells will ring with joy. Bring them home, bring them home. To welcome our darling girls and boys. Bring them home, bring them home. We'll lift their voice in song. Bring them home, bring them home. Yeah, when Johnny comes marching home. Bring them home, bring them 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 home. Bring them home.
That was Bruce Springsteen with a recent cover of a Pete Seeger classic. Now here's Robert Fisk speaking in September 2008. Fisk had been wondering at the growing catalog of atrocities committed by U.S. soldiers in Iraq, particularly torture. A letter from a soldier's father provided him, not with a map, but at least with a guidepost, when the Pentagon rewrote a little pamphlet called The Soldier's Creed. That was a sign that the dehumanization was underway.
In the week that George Bush took to fantasizing that his blood-soaked war on terror would lead the 21st century into a shining age of human liberty, remember that? I went through my mailbag to find a frightening letter addressed to me by an American veteran whose son is serving as a lieutenant colonel and medical doctor with U.S. forces in Baghdad. He's just come home safely, by the way. Put simply, my American friend believes that the change of military creed under the Bush administration, from that of soldier to that of warrior, is encouraging American troops to commit atrocities. From Abu Ghraib to Guantanamo to Bagram to the battlefields of Iraq and to the black prisons of the CIA, humiliation and beatings, rape and anal rape and murder have now become so commonplace that each new outrage is creeping into the inside pages of our newspapers. My reporting notebooks are full of Afghan and Iraqi complaints of torture and beatings from August 2002 and then from 2003 to the present. How I keep asking myself, did this happen? Obviously, the trail leads to the top. But where did this cult of cruelty begin? So first, here's the official U.S. Army Soldiers' Creed, originally drawn up to prevent any more Vietnam atrocities. In fact, it was written after My Lai. And after this, every U.S. serviceman, wherever he was in the world, carried this document. I am an American soldier. I am a member of the United States Army, a protector of the greatest nation on earth. Because I'm proud of the uniform I wear, I will always act in ways creditable to the military service and the nation that it is sworn to guard. No matter what situation I am in, I will never do anything for pleasure, profit, or personal safety which will disgrace my uniform, my unit, or my country. I will use every means I have, even beyond the line of duty, to restrain my army comrades from actions disgraceful to themselves and the uniform. I am proud of my country and its flag. I will try to make the people of this nation proud of the service I represent, for I am an American soldier. I think that's pretty eloquent. I've got nothing against that. And here's the new version, however, of what is now called the warrior ethos, introduced by Donald Rumsfeld, which American servicemen now carry with them. I am an American soldier. I am a warrior and a member of a team. I serve the people of the United States, and I live the Army values. I will always place the mission first. I will never accept defeat. I will never quit. I will never leave a fallen comrade. I am disciplined, physically and mentally tough, trained and proficient in my warrior tasks and drills. I always maintain my arms, my equipment, or myself. I am an expert, and I am a professional. I stand ready to deploy, engage, and destroy the enemies of the United States of America in close combat. I am a guardian of freedom and the American way of life. I am an American soldier. Like most Europeans, and an awful lot of you, I was quite unaware of this new and ferocious code for U.S. armed forces, although it's not hard to see how it fits in with Bush's rantings. I'm tempted to point this out in detail, but my American Vietnam veteran did so with such eloquence in his letter to me that the response should come in his words. The warrior creed, he wrote, allows no end to any conflict except total destruction of the enemy. It allows no defeat and does not allow one ever to stop fighting, lending itself to the idea of the long war. It says nothing about following orders. It says nothing about obeying laws or showing restraint. It says nothing about dishonorable actions. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe that that warrior ethos, that document, paves the road to Bagram and Kandahar prison and to Guantanamo and the black underground prisons, which we know are also existing in Europe. That is the road to torture. In this way, I believe that your armed forces have been demeaned. And it came from the top. This came from the Pentagon. This was not just a few bad apples.
Let's tie a few threads together. Normal people are averse to killing people. In World War II, the American soldier was expected to kill armed, uniformed soldiers of the opposing side. Even so, 90% of American soldiers would refuse to kill the enemy. Today, the American soldier is expected to kill primarily civilians, and now he does readily. There's been a revolution in U.S. military training since 1945, and it has necessarily, and radically, increased the number of sociopaths in uniform. You create an army of sociopaths, and they're going to be raping their colleagues, killing their colleagues, torturing prisoners, and, when they return to civilian life and civilian values, committing suicide in record numbers. The crises are related, and, as Dar Jamail observes, the Pentagon can't do a thing about them without reconceiving its own mission and tactics, which it won't. Thanks for listening to New World Notes. Hope to see you again next week.